How do you do? Jen and Cam feel it would be unkind to present this program without a friendly word of warning. We are about to unfold our true crime podcast, a podcast of lifelong friends who seek to examine crimes which were committed without reckoning upon God. The discussion will be frank, and the subject matter will be of a grim and violent nature. I think it will thrill you. It might even horrify you. So, if there are young children listening, or if you feel unwilling to subject your nerves to such a strain, now is your chance to... Well, we've warned you.
Hello, Jen.
Hey, Cam, how are you?
I'm deliciously wonderful. Jen, have you been watching anything good on the old boob tube? Anything, you know, with Halloween and the spooky time of October and November?
You know what? I haven't had time. To be quite honest, I haven't had time to watch anything really big and spooky lately.
What?
Have you? I've been busy. This whole past week, I've had nothing but a headache. I've had migraines because of the weather. And then once the migraine gets done, I've had tooth problems and think I need a root canal because yay. But no, I haven't watched anything. Sorry. Sorry, I've got better things to do than sit on my bum and watch the TV.
Well,
all
technically,
the time.
You were sick, so you weren't busy. So you were laying on your bum all week. You just didn't feel good.
Well, not really. I was still getting up and doing stuff. So have you seen anything good?
Yes, of course I have. I watched Spiral this morning on Shudder TV, and then I watched Host on Shudder TV. I subscribed to Shudder for the good old Halloween season and November season. Have you seen Midsommar? Did you ever watch that?
Yes.
That movie? Mm-hmm. Slow burn, but creepy, right?
Like just kind of creepy. It was fine. It didn't move quick enough for me to pay attention to.
Yeah. Did you see Cam? About the Cam girls? The camera?
No.
It's good. Stephen King actually likes that one. What haven't I watched? Let's be honest.
I've been keeping up with The Great British Bake Off.
Oh, okay. That's
I
good.
Love
That's
that.
Good.
Happy I love TV. Me some Paul Hollywood. Mm-hmm. I've got to get all my the lingo down since we're going to go to CrimeCon June in London.
London, England.
Cannot wait. It's going to be so much fun.
It
and
really
if you guys want to come with us, you can use our code OTCP and get 10% off your tickets and come
and hang
see
out
us.
With us.
And hang out with
what,
us.
Can you even put a price on that, Jen? I don't think so. I think Mm-mm. not, my friend.
There's no price.
No price.
All right. Do you got something for us?
I do, Jen, and I've been feeling a little reminiscent, shall we say, of the past, and just been thinking, since we're going to London, England, a lot about true crime and things like that, and how what I did to get into it and all that stuff. So there was a case that happened a long time ago, and I remember watching it and hearing about it. In fact, I think we had just graduated high school, and so this is probably a familiar case, but I needed to go back and look at it with my true crime eyes versus my teenage eyes, which are vastly different these days.
Oh, it's some... Yep.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So you're probably familiar with this, but there'll be some parts in here that you'll be like, oh, okay. So here we go. You ready?
Mm-hmm. Yep.
Both you and I love the... Well, you know, and this is a little inside joke we have. You know, there's a fine line between, and you and I will always say, well, there's a fine line between something and something, depending, and we just make it work to our, you know, advantage.
Mm-hmm.
I'm going to start it with this. So Oscar Levant said there's a fine line between genius and insanity, and I truly believe in that. Mm-hmm. Sometimes the lines blur, and, you know, usually you are a little bit off when you're genius. Look at me.
Yeah.
Right?
No, that's not...
Not the same. I know.
It's deeper for you. Yeah.
It's deeper. All right. Jen, today we are getting in a time machine and we are venturing back to 1988.
Woohoo.
I know, right?
Ma so Bangs. Loves Baby Soft.
That's right.
Babe perfume.
Babe. There you go. Today we're going to be visiting Florida in a town called Alturas, where a man received a strange and anonymous letter in the mail. The note, which had been typed, simply stated, you and all your so-called family have 2 weeks to move out of Florida forever or else you will all die. This
what?
Is no joke. That's what the letter said. And it was typed on, I want to say like a post-it note kind of thing. It was a small piece of paper, right? So like anybody that's pretty, I don't know, would you take that seriously or would you be like, what? This is
not
weird.
Not really.
Right? Because it's just kind of bizarre.
It's like those phone calls nowadays. The IRS is putting a hold on your Social Security number.
Yeah,
no, I wouldn't
right?
believe it. No.
Of course. So the man...
My so-called family?
Yeah, right. Well, there's a reason for that, see, because there's always a reason, John. So the man that lived at this house was a man by the name of, and I hope I get this right, Perilyn. I think that's it. Perilyn Carr, but he goes by Pi. Thank you. Thank you for going by Pi, really. Okay. And by all accounts, he was a well-liked man who was admired by all who knew him.
I was going to say I'd always go for Pi, but...
Yeah, right.
Yeah.
Pi thought for sure this had to be some kind of prank. And besides, you know, he had his hands full with other things. For instance, Pi had just remarried recently to a woman by the name of Peggy. Peggy had moved into his house along with her son from a previous marriage. Now, the two of them would be joining her new husband, Pi, and his stepson. But that's not all, Jen. Pi had converted his garage into a small apartment for his daughters, Delina and Tammy, along with his granddaughter, Casey Bell. So the house is, you know, it's pretty packed. So if you take a look at that letter now, you see the so-called, right? Because it's a mixed family. The kids would often be outside hanging out, being loud, because some of them were in their teens. Thank you. They're, you know, teenagers. And then the other ones were just in their early 20s.
If they're being loud, it's either kids or Camille. So
thank you. There you go. So they're, you know, they're doing what teens do, as a matter of fact. They're riding dirt bikes. They're setting off fireworks, bottle rockets, Roman candles, playing music loud, having friends come over, swing by, you know, hang out, all that stuff that you do when you have kids. Now, sometimes the Carr family would get along well with each other, and other times it was like wrestling, right? Like WCW wrestling at the Chase is what I wanted to say there. But, you know, they're fighting. They're all about the same age. And, you know, moving in there, it had to be hard. Quite the adjustment for all of them. Let's put it that way. So it was a very noisy house for sure. But, you know, they're all trying to make the best of it and they're trying to have a successful run at a new marriage. But, you know, there was already a little bit of trouble in paradise. So as if the teens and the young adults in the house weren't enough to handle, Peggy was starting to wonder or think that maybe her new husband was stepping out on her. Now, they had been married less than a year at this point, okay? On October 23rd, 1988, Peggy woke up bright and early for her waitressing shift at a nearby restaurant. Everything seemed to be fine. Peggy worked there along with her daughter, Sissy. So they kind of worked a little bit different shifts, you know, because waitressing has the shift, you know, the early shift, the mid shift, you know what I'm saying? Like people come in at different times to cover for each other. Mid-afternoon, Peggy started not feeling well, and her daughter, Sissy, had just come in to the cafe and was beginning her shift. And Peggy told her daughter, you know, I don't feel right. Like, my stomach feels funny. My feet feel funny. Now, her daughter's like, you know what? You probably ate something bad. Why don't you go home, lay down, take a little nap, and hopefully you'll feel better.
She ate something wrong, so her feet hurt?
Mm-hmm.
Or their feet, okay.
That's just, you know, you think that, right? So Peggy did.
No,
she went.
But okay.
Okay. So Peggy went home. She laid down on the couch and she kind of started feeling worse, not better. Her son, Dwayne, arrived shortly after she had went home to lay down, and he spoke with his mom and said that his mom was complaining now of chest pains and that there were some really strange pains in her feet again. Now at this point, Peggy was struggling to stand and was having trouble even walking. Okay, so this is like mid-afternoon, very early evening. As the day turned into night, Peggy was losing the ability to even speak. It was clear at this moment that something was way wrong and it was way more than food poisoning.
Thanks.
She could no longer open her eyes. Peggy was rushed to the hospital. After days of testing, doctors could not find the cause of this weird illness. But, you know, after she had been in the hospital for a few days, she seemed to be getting better. So Peggy was sent home to recuperate at home. There was even a doctor that made an innuendo that maybe this was all in her head because they couldn't find anything, which
Lord.
Is the wrong thing to do, of course, but I'm sure it happens. So she goes back home. She lays down. You know, she was on the mend. She was getting better in the hospital. Strangely, it's just days later, her sickness was back, and it was way worse this time. The pain was intolerable. But unlike last time, both her son, Dwayne, and her new stepson, Travis, were also feeling weird. They were feeling these strange pain things in their feet. And, you know, one of them had described it as if your foot fell asleep, but with pain. You know, the needles, pins and needles.
Yeah.
But it was hurting. So it was like the pins and needles were like little razors, right? Slicing them. All three of them were admitted to the hospital, where it was clear now something was not right. Doctors are starting to wonder if maybe the family had been poisoned. But that only brought about more questions, such as who in the world would poison this family? And as I stated earlier, there were a lot of them living in the house. So why only these three? And how would these three alone be poisoned? Right?
Mm-hmm.
Peggy begins to get worse. She is now unable to speak, and she's starting losing her hair. Her hair is falling out in big clumps. After her hair began falling out, she just became much worse. She eventually fell into a coma, and on March 3rd, 1989, her husband, Pi, made the heartbreaking decision to pull the life support from Peggy. Mm-hmm. The boys also started losing their hair, and Travis was eventually placed on a respirator. Now, thankfully, both boys would recover, but now authorities have a murder to solve.
I think being poisoned would be to slowly die would be right? horrific.
And this is a terrible way to die, too. Odorless, tasteless.
Mm-hmm.
Jen, with the murder, it's now time for the police to become involved. The Polk County Sheriff's Office step in, determined to figure out what is happening to this family. First up, investigators go to the family home. They know it's poison. They have no idea what kind of poison. So with this in mind, they have to test everything. They test the water. They test the soil. They test food elements in their refrigerator, like sour cream. They test for any and all poisons around the home. They test serving utensils and bowls, cups, anything like that, looking for mm-hmm. trace amounts of poison. They come back with nothing. They don't have anything. As they're looking around, they're thinking, what the heck could this be that only three people would be poisoned, right? So they're looking around, and then they notice that there is a six-pack of soda bottles on the ground. Coca-Cola, to be exact. Coke, you can send us your money if you want. That's okay. In the six-pack of the bottles, these were glass bottles, remember back in the day?
Mm-hmm.
In the kitchen, the empty bottles had been placed back in. So there were a couple bottles that had been drunk. So they noticed that the six-pack of sodas in the kitchen, there are a couple bottles that had not been touched. They still had soda in them. And you remember back in the day, you drink your soda bottles and then, or you drink your soda. And when you're done with the bottle, you put it back in because you get to take it back in for 10 cents and buy bubble gum with all your riches at Walgreens.
Yeah, I mean, Barb, we did that with Frikes. That was my job, was to return the soda bottles.
Mm-hmm. Authorities send off those soda bottles thinking, you know, the sealed ones had not been opened yet, but the empty ones possibly. So let's send those off. So they send them off, and it's not long before they get a hit on one of the empty soda bottles. In fact, it was in all of them. Now, at this point, they're expecting the old standard arsenic or ethylene glycol, which is the poisonous substance found in antifreeze. But what they find would be shocking. The bottles were laced with traces of a metal called thallium. Mm-hmm. So what is thallium? Little deep dive here on thallium. Thallium was discovered in 1861 by a man named Sir William Crookes. It is tasteless and odorless and has been used by murderers as a very difficult to detect poison over the years. The metal can be found in the Earth's crust. Interesting to note here that thallium has not been produced in the United States since 1984, but it is still imported for use in the manufacture of some electronics low-temperature thermometers, optical lenses, and imitation precious jewels, which is so right. weird. Why would you put that in precious jewels? But okay.
And it's also water-soluble, right?
I don't know that. Maybe.
It is. It's water-soluble, and it also could be absorbed through the skin.
Oh, okay.
So not only can you easily digest it without knowing, it's you can also, by touching it too much, you can get poisoning from it.
That's what she said. Mm. Now, traditionally, and perhaps a bit ironically, thallium was used as a rodenticide, but has since been banned in the United States due to its toxicity from accidental exposure. And I guess that would be like what you said, the touching.
Yeah.
But I think that's funny because you're using it for to kill rodents, mice and rats, right? But they ban it because it could kill people too. See what I'm saying? Like,
yeah. Well, most poisons can kill people
yeah,
too.
It's
banned because it's highly poisonous, not just, it's bad. It's just a bad thing.
I didn't know you were a thallium expert.
I'm very
impressed. All right, Jen, I hope that you noticed that this poison was banned in 1984 and this.
4 years later, so somebody could easily still have some.
There you
go. Hanging out.
Mm-hmm. Correct. The investigation would soon turn into a murder investigation as 41-year-old Peggy Carr lost her life due to what they believe at this point was thallium poisoning. The parent company of Coca-Cola stood quickly up to say, hey, guess what? There's no other reports of poisonings anywhere in the area. Also, it is nearly impossible for the poison to be found in just 6 bottles in the exact same carton, right?
Right.
And that, so we're looking at something that's obviously somebody has tampered with the soda bottles.
I'm sure Coke was freaking out. That they were going to have another Tylenol.
That's exactly what I was thinking, right? So it did turn out that all 6 bottles had traces of thallium in them. Okay. At this point, because it is a product tampering case, the FBI was called in.
Mm-hmm.
The FBI was able to determine that each of the bottles not only contained the poison, but each one had been opened, laced with thallium, and then sealed back to look as if it had never been opened. Because, of course, like you're not going to, plus it would go flat if it was open, right? At this point, investigators are now leaning to the thought of a person or persons purposely targeting the Carr family. But who in the world that would want to hurt them, right?
That's what I'm wondering. Again, tell us.
I'm glad you are, Jen.
You're leaving me hanging, bro.
As it is so often the case, police begin to look more closely at those around the Carr family and who may want to hurt them. First up is Peggy's new husband, Pi. Now, it seemed the weekend that this all started, Pi, conveniently, was out of town on a hunting trip. Now, at first, they thought maybe this was just a little bit all too convenient, right?
Mm-hmm.
But then again, after they kind of, I guess, got their wits about him, they begin to think, yeah, it's one thing for Pi to poison his new wife. However, his son was poisoned as well. And he adored his son, as you should, right? His son was also the one that got it worse than Dwayne, which was her son, right? So his son, Travis, was placed on a ventilator. So tests come back showing that Pi actually had drank some of the soda as well. And he, too, had small trace amounts of the metal in his system. However, he was kind of a bigger guy and didn't drink as much soda, so obviously it would not affect him as much as it would the others.
Right.
After quickly clearing the husband and father, investigators begin to look into friends and acquaintances to see, you know, who the family may have had a beef with, and they didn't have to look too hard or for too long. It seems that one of Carr's neighbors had recently gotten into a verbal agreement out in the front yard. Peggy's son, Dwayne, and his friends were outside hanging out, listening to music, and
being loud.
Teens are rather deaf when it comes to their music or listening to their parents. However, they can listen to all other stuff that they choose to hear. And all that loud music really bothered a neighbor. She came out of the house screaming and yelling at the top of her lungs at those teens, telling them to turn down that noise, blah, 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 blah. So Peggy is inside and she hears all this. And she comes running outside to see who's yelling at her kids. So Peggy and the neighbor got into it. And let's just say, as my grandma used to say, they were using lots of potty words to each other, right?
Mm-hmm.
Now, this was not the first time that the neighbor, whose name was Diana, and her husband, George, often came out to scream at the cars and the Carr's kids about their behavior. The neighbors, Diana Carr, no relation, by the way, and her husband, George Trepaw, had some big arguments with the Carr family, and neither really liked the fact that Pye moved in, and even more so, moved in lots of people with him, and that happened to, you know, the number of people happened to expand after he married Peggy and she moved in with her child. So Diana and George, you know, they're not like a lot of people. In fact, Jen, they are among an elite group of people. No, they're not podcasters. They're not us. They're not that cool, right?
They're not that elite. Yeah.
They're not that elite. They are in a group of people that score in the top 2% of the general population academically. That is right. Both Diana and George belong to Mensa. Mensa, as you may or may not know, and I'm sure you don't because why would you? Because neither did I, was founded in England in 1946 by a barrister named Roland Barrell and Dr. Lance Ware, a scientist and lawyer. The two gentlemen, they had created this club, well, I guess organization would be a better word, because they wanted to have a place, a society, if you will, for bright people. Now, the only qualification for membership was having, just like you, Jen, a high IQ. Okay. When the detectives canvassed the neighborhood to gain insight into what kind of people the Carrs were, meaning the people that were tormented, and who may want to hurt them, all was fine until they went to Diana and George's house. Now, Diana told officers that they didn't really care for the family, the Carrs, but it was actually George who piqued their interest. Investigators said George was fidgety, he was acting odd, but that was not the cherry on top, Jen. When he was asked why someone would poison the Carr family, why would anyone want to poison this family? Instead of giving the old, you know, the old token answer, such as, I don't know, or whatever, George
Our
said,
answers.
You're right, I don't know. George said, without missing a beat, someone wanted them to leave. Okay, that's not exactly the first thought that pops into your mind, right? What,
no.
Police officer. So the statement sounded a little bit like that anonymous note telling the family to leave or else. Now, a little bit of background of good old George and Diana. Diana was an orthopedic surgeon. She worked constantly, so obviously she was very intelligent. Her friends would say that she definitely wore the pants in the relationship. She kept George on a short leash, and George was kind of he was extremely brilliant, but at this point, he was not working, okay? He often would accompany Diana to work, or so he said. And he, you know, kind of piddled around the house and did things like that.
Was he, like, so smart that he couldn't function in normal everyday life?
Well, he was a little goofy. He was a little goofy, and I mean that with love, because I like goofy. But he was a little, like, wouldn't look you in the eye, kind of. One of the boys, I think it was Dwayne, said that when he came out to get his mail, he was harmless. This is what Dwayne said. But he was the kind that would wear, like, mismatched Hawaiian shirt with Hawaiian pants, with black socks pulled up to his knees, and, like, sandals to go get the mail, which is fine. No judgment, right?
Mm-hmm.
But he said he just seemed like very innocent, very not threatening, right? So put it that way. And definitely Diana, whatever she said went, right? So she ruled over George. Let's just put it that way.
Yeah.
Now, George had taught himself how to program computers. And you got to remember, this is in the late
1988,
80s.
1988,
yeah. So that's pretty good.
Yeah.
As well as the ins and outs of chemistry. So he taught himself how to be a chemist and how to be good at being a chemist. Now, Jen, here's where we see that George was like Walter White before there was Walter White, if you know what I'm saying.
He liked to make things in the chemist's lab?
Yes. Ding, ding, ding. You are correct. Mm-hmm. As in, George was no stranger to drugs. In fact, he had been arrested in 1975 for manufacturing meth. Not only manufacturing it, he was basically the head chemist for this, big meth-selling ring, and they got busted. He'd served some prison time. I think it was about 3 years.
That's why he's unemployed. Yeah. Okay.
So he had served some prison time. I believe it was 3 years. But he was adamant, even when he was in jail. this is such a racket and such a good way to make money. The minute I'm out, I'm going right back in the meth game, right?
Mm-hmm.
Jen, George not only liked to make drugs, he liked to take them on occasion. Now, that's fine. That's all good. You know, you do you, boo-boo. You do mm-hmm. you, boo-boo, George, in your own time. But, you know, he also liked to share his drugs with people. Again, you know, sharing's caring, Jen. But, you know, George would share them with strangers, to be exact.
Oh,
you know,
really?
Strangers like hitchhikers. But the thing is, they didn't really consent or, in fact, know this little small detail. So, for instance, he would make drugs, you know, at home and trying out different drug combinations of things and how they work on different people and the amount, I guess, dosage, if you will. So he'd maybe, you know, make some brownies or some whatever, hide the drugs in food and then give it to people and sit back and watch. He liked doing that, right? So they didn't know. They thought they were eating a brownie, but they didn't know it was laced with LSD, homemade, or meth, or whatever.
Right. Nice, nice. That's so not cool.
Right? He liked it. He thought that was fun. He also would, apparently, when he was in college, somebody was breaking into his dorm room, and so he decided to teach them a lesson while not even having to exactly teach it. So apparently he laced the doorknob with some hallucinogenic drugs. And the person that touched it, it would soak in the skin, much like you were saying earlier with the thallium. Mm-hmm. And, you know, he just kind of liked the fact that he got back, but they didn't even know it, got back at them, right?
Mm-hmm.
So we all know at this point, George is a piece of work, that's for sure. But his Walter Whiting, if you will, with his homemade meth, revealed something oh so very telling, Jen. Can you guess one of the ingredients that is used in making meth?
Yes, Sudafed.
Okay. Yep. That's not what I want, though. Keep
going. What about, let's see, propane?
I believe so.
Because I know in the area that we grew up, a lot of people get their propane tanks stolen because yep. of methamphetamine.
And fertilizer. They use fertilizer, too.
Yeah.
I guess it's more of like a byproduct of making meth, if you will.
No, then I don't know.
It's thallium, Jen. It's thallium.
Oh, thallium. Nice.
Yes. So at this point, authorities are pretty darn sure that George Trapal is not only their suspect, but he is the one that may have done this, right? I mean, you only need so many arrows pointing to you, you know what I'm saying?
Mm-hmm.
They need more. They need solid evidence. Just having this all doesn't mean anything. They need something else. So what they need, Jen, is a plan. Or better yet, they need a frenemy. And we know about frenemies. Enter an undercover detective by the name of Susan Gorick. Hmm. Now, for fun, and I thought this was kind of funny, because it's, I tell you, just because you think you can be a one on TV does not make you one. I'm just saying.
No.
For fun, one of the things that Diana liked to do was to learn about and investigate true crime.
Uh-huh.
Mm-hmm. Now, one of the things that George liked to do in his spare time was role playing. So the couple decide, I know it's, you can't write this, you can't make this
match
up.
Me, Nevin, yeah.
Right? Thank you. You should see him too. Bless their little hearts. So the couple decided to host a murder mystery weekend with all their Mensa friends. At this point, investigators had a little idea. Woo! With George and Diana hosting the murder mystery weekend, what mm-hmm. better way to have Detective Susan be invited, right?
Perfect, yeah.
So she's going to go, and she's going to go under a fake name, a persona that was developed for her.
Was she going to go by Sue?
Sherry.
Oh.
Okay. I was like, did you see this before? No. So under the fake name, and they, you know, they gave her a personality and things to go by, which they believed would attract somebody like George. So the weekend of murder and fun involved dressing up and portraying your character you were assigned. You know, mm-hmm. we've done that.
That was really a big deal in the 80s to do murder mystery weekends.
Oh, yeah.
Or that, parties. We actually did one in drama class in high school.
Yeah, we did. That's right. We did. Oh, mm-hmm. yeah. I forgot about that. So George created a booklet because, you know, that's what he does. He created a booklet for the weekend festivities, and it was sort of a how-to guide, right?
Mm-hmm.
However, detectives would find a passage from the book that once again piqued their interest. Just like the anonymous note that was delivered to the cars telling them to leave or else, there was a paragraph in this little murder mystery booklet. The paragraph said something to the effect of, "Most things on a neighbor's doorstep is just a way of saying they need to move or else."
Huh.
Right. It went on to say that if somebody gets a note like this, they should be warned that, you know, perhaps their food or drink may be poisoned.
Huh.
Now, here's where I'd like to say George may be a genius, but he is not very smart, right? Good thing there's not an undercover cop there to see all this. Oh, wait. Yeah, there is. I mean, come on. That's textbook, yeah. George. Authorities were pretty sure he would confess this whole thing to Detective Sherry. Well, I mean, let's just go by Sherry right now. And they also thought, you know, she's going to weasel in there. She's going to be able to get him to confess and everything. But, you know, George is, he is smart by Mensa standards, I guess. And they're kind of thinking this whole operation won't take too long. But boy, were they wrong. The investigation that had been dubbed Pale Horse after the Agatha Christie novel would continue on for just a little bit over 2 years. Now, he would say little things, but never, ever, you know, like little weird things like the murder how-to booklet at the weekend. Just little things, you know, that would be telling, but nothing that would give investigators something solid that they needed, right? Mm-hmm. By the way, in the novel by Agatha Christie, the killer uses thallium to poison his victims. Detective Sherry, when she was over at his house one time, even saw a copy of the book on his table, coffee table. Right.
Doesn't mean anything, but yeah.
It doesn't mean anything. I mean, it's Agatha Christie. Crispy. Mm-hmm. Agatha Christie. Detective Sherry was working hard to get into George's good graces and Diana's, but she knew he was really smart and she had to come out and she knew that he would never just come out and say he was responsible for the crime. Now, a big break came when George and Diana moved out of the house and to a nearby town that was about 20 minutes away. Sherry saw her move. So she had earlier told George that she was going through a divorce. This was at the murder mystery game. And, you know, her whole persona was to kind of play somebody that, let's see, how can I word this? So George was very smart. He was one of those people that thought he was always smarter than everybody, right? Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And so they kind of had Sherry portray a little bit like she's a strong woman. They wanted to make sure that George felt that he had a little bit of power over Sherry because he didn't get that at home with Diana. Let's put it that way. I'm thinking this as I'm saying all this. So Sherry had told George that she was going through a divorce and the husband was terrible and was, you know, trying to take her for her money and stuff like that. And George had cracked a joke, you know, if you really want to get rid of him, just poison him. It's the best thing to do. And so little things like that would, you know, come up. But again, that's not hard to evidence. So when George and Diana moved out of the house, Sherry saw her move and she's like, bam. So she went to George and Diana and she said, you know, actually, I'm kind of a little bit down my luck because of the husband and I'm looking for a place to rent. And bada bing, bada boom, they took the bait. The couple agreed to rent the house to Sherry, aka Detective Susan. She moved in the house, like she full on moved in the house, which I think is a crack up, right? But now that she's in the home.
Like with everybody? Like her?
No, this is just the detective. Oh. This is the detective moved in to George and Diana's home because they moved out.
Okay, gotcha. Okay, I wasn't following. Okay.
So the couple agreed to rent the home to Sherry, a.k.a. Detective Susan. Now, she moved in the house, and once she's in the home, the Polk County Sheriff, they get to go in free and clear. They get to go in free and clear because being a renter, you know, George had given her permission to stay in the house, and therefore she gets permission to tell a police officer if he can come in and search the house. So they get to get in there, and they get to take a good look around. They locate several bottles, you know, some empty, some full, some half full, whatever. But none of them were thallium. None of them tested positive for thallium or thallium residue. So they all started to get a little bit down, and then it finally happened. They locate a bottle with a little bit of white powder in the bottom. Bam! It was tested, and it was thallium. Ha ha! That's all they need, right?
Wow,
but this was
this.
Well, let me just say this too. This was in a detached garage on their property. Okay. Mm-hmm. And we'll get back to that in a minute, right?
Okay.
You know, if you had, for instance, your shed that you and your husband have in the backyard, you can't be guaranteed that nobody could get in there and you wouldn't know it, right? Because you probably don't go out there every day. So just kind of keep that in mind, okay? But we'll come back to that. Now that investigators have some evidence, they head to George and Diana's new house with an arrest warrant in hand. A very angry Diana answered the door. She's screaming at cops. I think basically they had to secure her. They had to like hold her down. And they said, you know, we're here for George. George stands up. He comes to the top of the stairs and all he has on is the cute little pair of bikini underwear. Oh, George.
That's so sexy.
So when they tell George, hey, you're under arrest, you got to come with us, George's only response was, can I put some clothes on? That would not be my first. I'd be like, what? But see, then again, I'd be innocent. So therefore, of course, that's what you're going to say, right?
No, you really don't want to go anywhere in your skivvies.
Especially jail.
Especially with what I'm thinking he might look like.
He's kind of short, little pudgy, and he's got thick glasses, little graying hair. You know, he was described by all who knew him as just kind of a science nerd, like a nerdy guy, right? So with George in custody, investigators search the house and they find a plethora of items. And well, George, it's not looking too good for him. They find books on poison, as well as books on chemistry and how-to guides, creating chemistry, turning it into things. But that's okay. This is what he liked to do. So that's not really guilty, if you were. However, there is a binder. And it's a binder of, I guess, like a collection. The best way I would say is that notes that he wrote on pages and like pages that he tore out of a book. So he's all keeping them secure. So he's like creating his own little how-to guide, if you were.
Gotcha. Okay?
And in the binder, they find several things. First off, the title on the front of the binder is, you ready? Mm-hmm. General Poison Guide.
Oh.
Okay, buddy. Inside were notes and photocopies of a book. And in the book, it detailed what happens to a person when they are poisoned by certain poisons. So, for instance, if you have arsenic, this is what's going to happen to the body and how death happens. If you're poisoned by antifreeze, this, whatever.
Right.
So they find a page with the details of thallium on it. And of course, it has George's fingerprints all over it. But, you know, that's to be expected. It is in his house. But why would you be looking at that unless you need to know? Right?
Thank you. Mm-hmm. Well, I mean, true crime podcasters might have a copy of that.
Well, I looked all this up, too. I'm telling you, I would be so arrested if somebody came to me.
Oh, same here.
History stuff, right? So in January 1991, it's been a while now, at the Polk County Courthouse, the trial of George Trepal begins. George was standing trial, being charged with 15 criminal counts, and this included attempted murder, first-degree murder, poisoning food or water, and product tampering. Prosecutors were seeking the death penalty since the crime actually put many more than just the one person it killed in harm's way. Mm-hmm. I mean, he could have knocked out, well, let's see, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, like 8 plus.
Five.
Yeah.
Yep.
Right?
Yeah.
George's defense maintained that all of this was circumstantial, and how could they ever put a man to death based on a bottle that was found in an unlocked garage? And that was the detached garage in the back of the house where the bottle was found with the thallium residue in it. And they maintained that, you know, that bottle could have been there for years and by someone else altogether, because they stated later, Diana and George stated that they never cleaned out the garage altogether. I mean, he is kind of a chemist. Come on now. Let's, you know, sometimes you just got to look at things and see what they are. And that they had left, this investigation had been for 2 years, and they maintained they never went out in that garage during that time, so that anybody could have put it back there, right?
I'm sure, yeah. Mm-hmm.
Anybody. They made sure to also insinuate that Diana could have been the killer, and that authorities went after George instead, but why were they so sure? Which is true. She was smart on her own. I mean, she wasn't a chemist, but she was a doctor, right?
She could have easily figured out a way to do it.
Totally. Or talk to him, right? She ruled the roost so much that I really believe that she could have done it and he would never admit that, right? So the trial would take 4 weeks, only 4 weeks, and then it went to the jury. The jury would deliberate only 6 hours before they returned a verdict of guilty on all counts. In a vote of 9-1, and when I wrote this, I kept thinking about, well, you probably don't watch, like, Big Brother. In a vote of 9-1.
No, I don't watch Big Brother.
That's how I read it in my head. George Trepal was sentenced to death on March 6th, 1991.
He got the death penalty for that?
He did get the death penalty. Because, wow. Like I said, he laced all those bottles. He could have killed all of them.
Right.
He could have killed the whole family.
But I guess we haven't had, like, a big death penalty. All the other losers have taken a plea deal.
Thank you. Right? I'm glad you brought that up, Jen. So Diana, who had always defended George and claiming he had the wrong person, somebody else went in the garage and did it, she did divorce George in 1996. Now, interestingly enough, Jen, because I checked today, because you just never know, George Trapal is still sitting on death row in Florida and has not even been given an execution date. Now, just for fun, just like, you know, last week you talked about the guy that was on the date an inmate website or whatever. George writes articles and columns for Mensa and Mensa magazine and various other things that he, I guess, submits his writing to. And he's actually received some awards from his writing, which...
Wow, while in prison.
Yeah, but he's smart, so there's that, you know?
Yeah.
So the whole reason I did this, like I said earlier, is that I was pretty... this was one of those cases that I remember a long time ago, and I didn't remember all the ins and outs. And so I was like, what was it? And I mean, I just was like, I had to Google it because I remembered it from memory. And it was like, guy who poisons neighbor, soda. Because that's all I could remember. And it popped right up. And then I was like, yeah, because that doesn't happen a lot.
No.
Right?
No.
So, and I didn't know thallium. I had to
Thank God it doesn't happen a lot. You couldn't remember thallium?
No, I didn't remember like what it was. So for instance, my son, who is a big science nerd, but we're not going to go there. He loves, and I think I have this right, gallium. I don't know if I said that right. I don't know, but it's a pliable metal. And he got, that's all he wanted for Christmas one year. And it's like, I don't know, it's funky do. But then also he gets MRIs and there's a dye, and I knew it was similar to that. It is similar, but it's not thallium. It's not gallium or whatever. It's something else, but in that same family, kind of, the dye that they put in there for the MRI. It's a dye, so it's not that, but I thought it was, is my point.
And you're right, it is gallium.
All right, Jen. Well, remember, until next time, lock your doors.
And keep passing by those open windows.
Bye-bye.
Love ya.
Today's episode was researched and written by me, Cam. For more information about this episode, as well as all the sources I used, please check out our show notes or the podcast website at ourtruecrimepodcast.com. Our True Crime Podcast is developed and created by hosts Jen and Cam. Original music and audio mix of all Our True Crime Podcast episodes is courtesy of Nico Vertese from We Talk of Dreams. Listener discretion is provided by Edward October from October Pod VHS. Our True Crime Podcast is executive produced by Nico Vertese and Dick Vain. Make sure to like and subscribe to Our True Crime Podcast wherever you listen to your podcast. We can be reached on Instagram and Facebook at Our True Crime Podcast or on Twitter at Our True Crime Pod. You can email us at ourtruecrimepodcast@gmail.com. If you really like the show, make sure to check out our Patreon at Our True Crime Podcast. Our True Crime Podcast is an OTC production.
Drinking a soda because guess what? I didn't buy any tea yesterday or Friday at the grocery store and I'm paying for it. Anyway, on March 3rd, 1989, Peggy then fell into a coma. No, I'm sorry. I got to say that again.
fell into a coma.
Yeah, because I read it backwards.
Hold on 1 second real quick, okay?
Yep.
I got to get up for a second.
You got to fart? You got to pass gas? You got to cough? Hi, Nico. Look, I'm going to talk to you like she always does. Hi, Nico. I love you. I know you love me more. It's okay.
Okay, sorry. I'm back.
Oh, she's back. Dun, dun, dun.
Dun, dun, dun.
I know. I lost my place here. There we go. In the six-pack of the bottles, these were glass bottles. Remember back in the day?
Mm-hmm. They still have those.
Well,
especially if you get like Mexican Coke.
Oh, yeah.
Which is so good.
Ew, I hated it.
Ugh. You hate Mexican Coke? You don't like Coke made out of real sugar?
No.
Oh. Nope. So much better than the corn syrup.
I'm sure it's so much better for you, too, but no. Yuck.
Oh, we always, when we go to Costco, which we're going to today, Costco, you can send us a check, too. We'll pick up a big flat of Mexican Coke.
Nope. Nope. No thanks. Mm-hmm. Mm-mm. The empty bottles had been placed back in. So there were a couple bottles that had been consumed. I get confused with drag and drug, right? I don't want to get drug across the mud again or the rocks. You know what I'm
exactly.
saying?
Exactly.
So much so that she came out of the house screaming and yelling at the top of her
Her youngs.
She's yelling at her youngs. And
I'm in Mensa.
Sure you are. You're in Cominza.
Mm-hmm. I'm in Minza. I'm circling around Minza. They haven't fully invited me yet, but they will.
Oh, okay. Okay. You're not in the inner circle or even
outer
circle.
I'm in the outer circle.
Of
Minza. Yeah.
You're like in the outer circle.
No, just right? The outer circle.
Okay.
I'm not even on the same block.
Like, I'm not even in the same town. Let's be honest.
No. Yeah. No, okay. I am. I'm on the outer rim of the circle of Minza. Yeah.
I like that. Okay. Mm-hmm. Now, the only qualification for membership was having, just like you, Jen, a high IQ.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Mine's really high.
Mm-hmm.
Mine's at least 90.
Oh, Jen.
No, honestly, when I was little, it was 135.
I don't think I've ever had one. I don't know. And now I don't want one because, you know what? Be honest right now, Jen. I've went all these years without knowing, and it could do twofold. Number one, I could, wow, Camille, you really are the smartest person in the room. Mm-hmm. Or it could do the other, which would be like, you are really that dumb? Like, and then that would be so bad.
It would hurt. Yeah, it would hurt.
So I'd rather just know.
I haven't had one as an adult. As a kid, it was really high, but you'd never know it.
No, you would not.
No.
Okay. Enter under the cut. Sorry.
Enter the Sandman. Yeah.
So the couple decided to host a murder mystery weekend with all their Minza friends. You should have been invited, Jen.
I should have, but like I said, I'm on the outer rim of the outer circle.
Right.
So honestly, my invitation could have gotten lost in the mail.
It's true.
That's what I'm thinking.
And maybe that's a good thing, right? You probably didn't.
My computer was down. It took up my entire room in the 1988, but you know.
It probably did, right? The whole house, let's be honest.
It did. My dad bought a computer for his office around that time, and it took up an entire side of a room. That's crazy. If you walked in there, he had to keep it really cold, because if you walked in there and you had any static electricity, it would die.
That's hilarious. Probably put off so much heat, too.
And you'd walk in and my dad go, don't touch anything! Don't touch anything!